Welcome to The B Word, a podcast about humans, organizations, behavior. I'm your host, James Healy. This is an episode about the most complex object in the known universe. It has 86 billion components linked together by more than 100 trillion connections. To try and put those massive numbers into some kind of context, earlier this month, scientists released the results of a project to map a small section of this object, a section smaller than a grain of rice. The results of that study are so complex, they occupy 1.4 petabytes of data. That's equivalent to the hard drives on about 1,000 high-spec laptops. This is one complicated object. You might be surprised to learn you have one. It is, of course, the human brain. This episode is about brains. It's about the science of brains, neuroscience. And it's about some of the practical uses of neuroscience, and just as interestingly, some of the misuses of neuroscience. Because complicated though our brains are, most of us are fascinated by them. And as it turns out, we're willing to believe almost anything about them. Joe Devlin is a professor of cognitive neuroscience at University College London. Joe's PhD is in artificial intelligence, AI, but he found himself much more interested in actual intelligence, the other AI, how the human mind works. After training in neuroimaging at Cambridge and Oxford, he established a reputation as a leading researcher in how the human brain processes language. He's a former head of experimental psychology at UCL, as well as the current vice dean for innovation and enterprise. He's collaborated on various projects with a variety of partners, including Audible, View Cinemas, NTT Data, the BBC, The Times, The Guardian, and The Daily Telegraph. Joe, good morning. Welcome.
Morning, James.
Thank you for joining me.
It's a real pleasure. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
So we're going to start with, the listeners have just heard me rattle off your potted bio, but we're actually going to start by talking about you a little bit. Am I right in saying that you actually started out in the field of artificial intelligence before you moved into the neuroscience field?
Yeah, that's right. I did my PhD in artificial intelligence in the 90s, so the last millennium. And when I put it in those terms, it makes sense how much AI has moved on in that time. But it was, you know, in the 90s, the thing that people were most interested in AI was search, like doing search in a smart way. And the reason for this was AI was focused on games. So the idea was that, you know, if you were intelligent, if you could play chess or you could play Go or something like that. And the way people did that was they thought about it in terms of game theory. So they had these incredible charts and trees about, if you make this decision, then what move makes sense for me to maximize the board, et cetera. So it was really a search problem. How do I search this incredible space to find an intelligent solution? And to my mind, that was possibly the most boring way to think about intelligence that I could imagine. And I was interested in artificial neural networks and things that have now been called deep learning. And that was the kind of work that I was doing. But it was really in its sort of infancy in the 90s. One of the things that was happening was that we'd make these models and people would say, well, it's sort of promising, but it's kind of crap, isn't it, really? And the general response was, well, I'll tell you what, if the computers were faster and stronger and had more memory and we had better data, these things would really work, I swear. And it turns out, I didn't believe that even at the time when I was saying it, but it turns out 25 years later, damn it, they were right. And the things that have changed, you know, in the last 2 years with Transformers and OpenAI and all of that are the AI that I wanted to be doing in the 90s. I was just at the wrong point in time. So I'm excited about the fact that AI seems to have come back to what seems to me to be true artificial intelligence. But of course, I'm now so far out of the field that I'm trying to relearn things really from the ground up.
So AI is going to be big. You heard it here first, listeners. It's one to watch. When I think about the transition from artificial intelligence to neuroscience, I can't help but think of the quote attributed to Amos Tversky. I don't know if it's real or apocryphal, but the quote that I'm sure you're familiar with, which is, "Some of my colleagues study artificial intelligence. I study natural stupidity." What was your rationale? What was your jump from the one sphere to another?
Well, for me, the thing was, I felt like the artificial intelligence, particularly in the late 90s, was real focus on artificial. And I thought, well, this is ridiculous. Some of these new brain imaging techniques are really coming into their own. Functional magnetic resonance imaging was sort of having its initial heyday. And I thought, the tools exist to know something about how actual human brains work. I should try to learn a little bit about that, and then I can bring it back to the AI side of things. I always was thinking really as a computational scientist rather than as a neuroscientist. And in my naivety at the time, I just thought, yeah, you know, I'll spend 3-4 years, figure out this brain thing, and then come back and apply it to computers. There's a long history of people who just think, oh, I'll just move in and learn this brain thing and figure it out. And I'm not a particularly notable member of that set, but it was a real act of hubris on my part. And 25 years on, I think the brain is absolutely fascinating, and I haven't really scratched the surface, but I've also become completely out of date in all of the developments in AI. So I am completely ill-positioned to do what I had hoped to do at the age of about 25.
Okay, well, it's to our benefit that you're stuck in neuroscience. I want to talk now about some of the things that you do with neuroscience, and particularly this area known as consumer neuroscience, where I know you've done a lot of work. So do you want to talk a little bit about what that is, what some of the use cases are, what some of the interesting ways that you've applied neuroscience to consumer problems?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So consumer neuroscience is sort of the academic way of saying neuromarketing. But neuromarketing has some funny implications depending on who you are, because there have been some very high-profile failures in neuromarketing. But the basic idea is summed up by a quote from David Ogilvy, where he says, look, consumers don't do what they say. They don't know what they want. I mangled that quote, my apologies. But the basic idea was that consumers, trying to understand consumer behavior is a really hard problem, because the main tool that we have is asking them in one form or another. And the problem is that people don't always know why they make these decisions. You've already mentioned Amos Tversky. Amos and Daniel Kahneman are the godfathers of this area. And of course, they spent their careers demonstrating that decision-making is actually a really hard problem, because people aren't completely rational. In fact, we have a whole set of systematic biases and influences and heuristics that we use, and they interact in really interesting and complex ways, which is why it's really hard for anybody to say, oh, well, I picked this product because they can always help tell you a story. The question is whether or not that story is right. And they're not trying to be perverse or you know, interfere with you. They often genuinely don't know. So the question then becomes, well, that information has to exist in their nervous system. Their nervous system is what was used to produce the choice. Can we use the tools of neuroscience, behavioral science, psychology, behavioral economics to try to answer this question about how they're making these decisions, what information is available to them that may influence their decision consciously or subconsciously? So can we get additional information beyond just simply asking them? It's not that one replaces the other, because they both give you insights, but consumer neuroscience is that study using the tools of neuroscience to try to get a deeper understanding of what consumers are doing in context. And for me, I actually think that even that term is a little bit misleading, because I don't think it's limited to consumers. I think that within an organization, you can use the same kind of approach to understand how teams are working, or how your partners or your board are coming to their decisions. the interesting problem is, you know, we're all people, and that comes with all of this complexity. So the question is, can we understand how people make decisions and are influenced using these tools in a variety of contexts? They aren't limited to just consumer making a purchase decision, for instance.
I think it's a great point. I spend much of my life somewhat tongue-in-cheek suggesting that HR departments ought to spend more time talking to marketing departments because, after all, they're both in the business of understanding and influencing humans. I've also got a personal pet wish list thing that I would love to strap some of my or some clients someday into some of the more neuroscientific technology that's available and do some neuroimaging. I think that would be an amazing thing to do. Do you want to talk a little bit about some of those techniques, some of the techniques that you've used, because they are really, really cool?
Sure. There are a number of tools that we use. The fanciest one would be functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI, which is a brain scanner. A lot of people may be familiar with this from frankly medical shows on TV. It's a giant cylinder tube that you lie in while we play an experiment, play a video, play advertisements. It depends on what question we're asking to you in the tube, and we can measure your brain activity through very subtle changes in the oxygen levels in the blood. So it turns out, as your brain becomes more active, specific parts of it increase their activity. They then increase their blood use because they need more nutrients. And we can measure those changes using this kind of non-invasive magnetic system. And that's incredibly powerful because it gives us a whole brain picture of what's happening on a sort of second-by-second basis. Now, mind you, thinking happens faster than that, but this is a practical limitation. Another one is, frankly, it's not a very normal environment. You very rarely lie on your back in a giant tube that's super loud while we play experiments at you. So it's not at all like walking through IKEA and making decisions about, whether or not you need this particular item or not. But nonetheless, it gives you some incredible insights, and it also gives you some incredible imagery. So there are two different uses of this, and they're not necessarily incompatible with each other. Normally, when people think about neuromarketing or they think about consumer neuroscience, they're thinking about the insights. They're thinking, can I get a better understanding of how this kind of a scenario affects consumers? And I'll give you an example. There's a type of advertising on television called addressable advertising, which your listeners may be very familiar with, but came as a surprise to me. But the idea with addressable advertising is just that we're trying to make sure that the ads are relevant to the household. So unlike those kind of micro-targeted ads that you get on Facebook or Google and YouTube and things like that are really tailored at you based on your search history, this would be a little bit more general than that. So it would be like, well, we know that the people in this house are of a particular age and they live in this particular area with its socioeconomic status, et cetera. So let's try to make sure that the ads are as relevant to them as possible. And the company that was interested in this came to us and said, can we see what's happening in their brain and how this affects their decision-making? Because we know that they attend to these more from other work that we've done. We know that they tend to remember them better. Let's try to understand what's happening in their brain. So we ran this MRI experiment where we had these volunteers come in, and we had pre-selected them based on their interest in certain categories of objects versus not. So whether you're a dog owner or not, whether you go on cruises or not, that kind of thing. And we had them just watch television shows that had ads embedded in them naturally while lying in the scanner. And what we could then do is we could look at the activity in their brain during these ads, even though they thought we were thinking about the show, and see that, for instance, when they were ads that were relevant to that person, it increases the sort of emotional reactions that we see in areas of the brain called like the amygdala. You see increases in visual attention in areas like the frontal eye fields and the interparietal sulcus that are very typically associated with attention. You see increases in the hippocampus, which is part of your brain that lays down new memories and retrieves new memories. So we see a variety of these kind of effects. We also saw increases in part of the brain called the ventral striatum, which is involved in the reward processing. And it was really remarkable. I honestly didn't expect to see quite so robust effects. But for Finecast, the company that was interested in this, this was essentially a sort of a thought leadership piece, because they can then go to the industry and say, look, we're interested in understanding why addressable makes such a difference. And we know from our analytics that we can see these effects in terms of, point of sales, and they have ROI models about what's going on. But it's quite another thing to say, we've actually partnered with the university to try to understand this from a neurological perspective. And we can see specific brain networks increasing their activity when they see ads that are relevant to them versus ads that aren't. And that's, I think, a really nice example of using it to produce insight. But it's not the only way you can use this. The problem with insight kind of studies like that is they tend to be expensive. To get good insight, you have to do good science, right? So it costs as much as running a normal fMRI experiment, which is typically six figures and takes months of time. But in contrast, we've also had other groups. We had a YouTube influencer named M. Ford, who is a beauty vlogger. And M came to us and said, look, one of the things I'm really interested in showing is that some of the industry's unrealistic portrayal of women has a negative effect, particularly on young women, because they not only pick these absolutely beautiful models, they then do professional hair and makeup, professional photography, and then they digitally retouch the photography, right? So it's an unattainable squared kind of beauty that's being portrayed. And we know that this actually has traumatic-like effects on young women who think, I want to look like that, but I know I never can. And this is actually fairly well understood. There's really good psychology about this. But M says, she's a YouTube vlogger, she wants to produce a cool video. So we got a couple of participants, normal, women, who went to M's studio. They had professional photography sort of before doing their professional makeup and hair, and then after, and then they had those images retouched. So we had normal people rather than supermodels, but nonetheless, they went through the same process. And then what we did was we brought them into the MRI scanner and we showed them images of both themselves, but also a larger cohort of people who had been in this. And what was really remarkable is that you can see this sort of increased activity in the amygdala, which again is a sort of an emotional center of the brain, when people are viewing these retouched images, these unattainable images. And it was consistent in every one of the participants. Now, to me, that wasn't incredibly surprising. That's what the literature suggests that you would see. But it's also characteristic signal of trauma-like responses that you see in people. And M, being a vlogger, was able to turn this into a very cool video that got a couple million views and a lot of media attention. So in that case, what we did was we sort of demonstrated something that we think we already understood fairly well. So it wasn't a new insight, but by producing the imagery, having the brains, the sort of cool, seductive appeal of neuroscience meant that it even enhanced her ability to reach out to audiences and get sort of media attention for the work that she's doing.
They're both fascinating examples. One phrase you used, we'll come back to the seductive appeal of neuroscience. I'd like to revisit that a bit later on. Something else I'd like to talk about now, though, is you talked there about the power of video. I believe you did a study a few years ago on the relative impact or the relative effect of audio versus video and how compelling the two media are. And I think this one might be a bit more surprising to people. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, that was a study that we did with Audible, the people who do quite a lot of the audiobooks. And Audible came to me and basically said, we'd like to understand what's happening in the brain when people listen to audiobooks. And I said, sure, I can tell you that. And I think they were completely surprised. And I said, no, we want to do some new research, produce new insights. So it took a little bit to identify an interesting question there. But the one we came up with was fascinating to me because I've worked in language for 20 years and no one had actually sort of looked at, which is, does the format of the story affect audience engagement with the story? So that is to say, if you're listening to the audiobook of Game of Thrones. Is that different the way you engage with it than if you're watching the HBO adaptation of Game of Thrones, right? Same story. And in fact, for that one, the versions tend to be really tightly close to one another. It's not always the case with video adaptations of books. But what we did was we identified a series of these books for which we had good video and good auditory versions. And we found emotional scenes in each of them that where the scene was really very true in both versions. So they didn't take a whole lot in the way of liberties in order to make sure that the content was as similar as possible. And we invited participants between ages 18 and 55, I think there are 72 of them, who came to the lab, and we asked them to watch four scenes from these books and listen to four scenes from four different books. And of course, we randomized that across people. So you didn't see Game of Thrones and then listen to Game of Thrones. You might see one version and I would listen to that version so that we could compare across people. And what we did was we not only used self-report, we did ask them using kind of standard behavioral measures about their audience engagement. We also put a biometric sensor on them so we could measure their heart rate, their electrodermal activity, which I'll explain in a second, and even their body temperature. So this is something that's like a glorified Fitbit, right? I mean, it sits on your wrist and it measures these signals without really your attention. And the thing about these signals is that heart rate and electrodermal activity, which is sometimes also known as the galvanic skin response, are physiological, that is bodily responses to changes in what's called your autonomic nervous system. So your autonomic nervous system controls a lot of what happens in your body. And when you experience an emotional change, then the amygdala, which is a brain region I keep mentioning, drives what's known as the hypothalamic pituitary axis. But those in the know just call it the HPA. What that does is it changes adrenaline levels in your body, which influences your heart rate. It influences your electrodermal activity. And we can measure that at the wrist. So we've got this kind of indirect measure of emotional trajectory of what's happening through these kind of biometric measures. And the results were really interesting because when you asked people using these kind of standard measures, they consistently preferred the videos to the books. So that is to say, they said that they paid more attention when they were watching the videos. They said that they felt more like they were present in the story when they were watching the videos. And they also felt more engaged by the videos. They didn't relate to the main character any differently, which was the only area that there was no change. So that wasn't exactly the story that Audible were hoping to hear, but they were actually really pleased with the physiological results because it went the opposite direction. That is to say, people's heart rates were 2 beats a minute on average higher when they were listening to the audiobooks than watching the stories. They showed greater electrodermal response. The heart rate had higher highs and lower lows. And their body temperature was up by about 0.4 degrees Celsius, which is kind of crazy, right? Because all they're doing is sitting in a booth by themselves. They're not doing anything physically active, et cetera. And in fact, we could confirm there were no differences in their physical activity because these little watches also measure physical activity. And there was nothing different between the two. And what that means to me is that they're actually working harder. When they're listening to the audiobooks, they have to be co-creators. You don't have everything laid out in front of you to just sort of take in. You have to imagine the voices, the scene, the setting, the sensation, and all of the characters and how they're relating to one another. And doing that requires more cognitive and emotional work on your part. And what's fascinating about that is we know from lots of other studies that the more effort that you put into it, the better you remember it, the more closely you're linked to the author's interpretation of these things, et cetera, because you have invested more in it, essentially. So even though many people came out and said, look, actually, I think in general, I preferred the videos to the audio, which is absolutely fine. There was this extra layer of information, which I think is a nice example of kind of the insights that you can get by adding these two things together. It doesn't end with, okay, I preferred the videos, that's the whole story. No, you engaged at a deeper level when you were listening to the audiobooks, which helps explain some of the popularity with audiobooks. And for me, one of the things that was exciting there were a couple things. One was we got an academic paper out of it in a good journal, which was brilliant. And I credit Audible with being very forward thinking about that. So sometimes organizations aren't excited about publishing it, the results as well, until you tell them that, of course, it'll be years from when the work's done until it actually comes out. Then they laugh and say, that's fine. But Audible changed the way they talk to authors. So previously, what they did was they'd bring plots of the Audible book market, right? And they would say, look, you've just published this new book. Look at how increasingly popular audiobooks are. We'd love to encourage you to do an audio version of your book. And if you don't, you're sort of missing out on a part of your market, and that would be a shame. So it was essentially a financial argument that they were making. But after this study, they changed that. So they still bring those, but now they lead with, look, we did this work with some scientists over at UCL, and what we found is that your audiences engage more deeply when they're listening to your book than, for instance, if they were watching a video adaptation. So if HBO comes to you, by all means, do that. That's great. However, if you don't do an audiobook, you are missing out on this better engagement, tighter relationship with your audience. And for most authors, they're not professional. It's not the way they do their jobs. Writing the book was some kind of passion project. So what they really want is that engagement with their audience. They want their readers, their listeners to be really involved. So this was the kind of thing that actually seems to have boosted the uptake of these one-off or, you know, relatively small number of book authors, as opposed to people who write books, you know, once a year or something, and that's their main way to live. So I was very happy with that.
Yeah, it's a great study. I mean, I just love the difference between the perceived outcome and the real outcome. The way that you interpret it personally, but what the data says. I think that's absolutely fascinating. And as you say, I think it really goes to the core of why this field is so interesting. But I think more generally, I'm absolutely fascinated by, I guess, the neuroscience of stories and storytelling. And, you know, every known human culture tells stories. And I think it's incredibly interesting that the point you made about co-creation, and that essentially part of the impact of storytelling is the listener imagining, co-creating with the person telling the story. I think that probably explains much of why stories are so compelling and so powerful.
Well, there's some really interesting neuroscience evidence to suggest that that's almost literally what's happening, right? Is that there was a group that did this study where they just got a person to relate an anecdote from their life. It was about 15 minutes, and it was a sort of an emotional experience. It had a very nice ending kind of thing. And they did this while the person was in the scanner, and they measured her brain activity while she was relating this story. And then what they did was they played that story to a set of volunteers in the MRI scanner one at a time and measured their brain activity. And what they found was that the listener's brain activity more or less matched the pattern of activity in the person telling the story from the first hand. So, you know, it's one of those sort of tropes, right? Is to walk a mile in another's shoes or to put yourself in another's situation. That's what stories do for us. Your brain activity literally starts to recreate the experience to the extent that it can. And of course, that varies from person to person, depending on your personal history and whatnot. But the general pattern seems to reproduce. And by doing that, you experience it, right? Like a good story is something that you live, and therefore it has a much greater impact.
Yeah, I think that's just amazing. It makes so much sense. As you say, there are these sort of throwaway lines that we all use. But it is really, really interesting that that is actually what's going on at a neurological level.
I completely agree. I mean, it as a scientist, I want people to pay attention to the evidence, right? Like, that's what I think they should really care about. But as a communicator, one of the things that I've had to learn the hard way is evidence is good. Stories are better. Stories are what actually motivate people. And if you have the evidence to back it up afterwards, so that anybody who wants to be skeptical, and I absolutely encourage that, you can then say, okay, yeah, I gave you an anecdote about this, but here's the evidence to support why this point is genuine and, you know, meaningful. But what people will remember are the stories.
So that is a great segue into a paper that I think you published some time ago now, but I was attracted to the title of this paper by the story, or the sort of implied story. And this is about learning to read, and a fairly unusual group of subjects, I think it's fair to say.
It certainly was. So I was interested in reading for a very long time, and I've studied how reading works in the brain. But one of the problems with trying to understand changes to the brain with learning to read is that for most of us, learning to read happens, you know, between 5 and 12 or something along those lines. And there's so many things that are happening at that time developmentally in the brain that isolating reading from the social development, all the other skills that are happening, and then the start of puberty, et cetera, is incredibly difficult. And you would think, oh, well, you could just look at adults who for some reason were illiterate and then learned to read. But in Western societies, that's incredibly rare. Normally, if somebody's reached adulthood and is functionally illiterate, there are other reasons for that. But there was this incredible opportunity that came up in Colombia. So when the Colombian government reached a peace agreement with the sort of longstanding communist rebel movement that was there, they were in a weird situation because there was a large number of people who were in these rebel groups, but they were largely uneducated. What they had was communist theory, which was always verbally shared, and the, you know, sort of practical skills, but they didn't really believe in general education. So these were healthy, normal adults who were, you know, 20 or 30, who had to now reintegrate into society, but didn't have a lot of the basic skills that would help them to do that. And the government, to their credit, said, look, we're just going to put together some programs to teach people to read and give them basic numeracy, et cetera. And we had the opportunity to do brain scans with some of these people before they started their reading training, during, and then after. And we compared that to others who were slightly later in the process so that we could compare similar people, similar ages, before and after they've learned to read. And what we could do is we could see changes of their brain, like physical structural changes to their brain that occurred just by learning to read. And because a lot of these rebels are known as guerrillas, and guerrilla is a word that can be misinterpreted, there was some very strange media coverage about teaching guerrillas to read, including my mother-in-law saying, I can't imagine how you could teach a gorilla to read. No, mom, it was rebel gorillas rather than apes. But it was fascinating because parts of the brain that are involved in visual processing, which are not surprising, you would expect that would be important, but also those that link to sort of auditory processing. So the combination of vision, sight, and sound, which of course is critical for reading. And this was in Colombia, so it was Spanish, and Spanish is a language where the sound, spelling sound correspondence is really tight. So if you know the basic rules of spelling, you know how the word sounds. It's more so than English that has all these rude little inconsistencies. It was remarkable to suggest that you could see these physical changes in brain gray matter, so the neurons themselves, as well as in the white matter, which are the connections between the neurons, that relate to how you link sound and vision together. And of course, that is fundamentally what reading is, and you do that in order to get to meaning so that you can get to the stories.
It's a great story. I wasn't aware of the confusion. That is quite amusing, to your point about Spanish being tied quite tightly to the sounds. I think it's pronounced gorillas or gorillas in Spanish to differentiate from the apes. We won't dwell on that. I think it's a wonderful example of, you know, neuroplasticity and the fact that the brain is a physical organ and it does physically change as you learn things and as you experience new things. which I think is something that not everybody would be familiar with, right?
Exactly. And to be honest, when I finished graduate school, so in the late 90s, and when started to learn about the brains, the received wisdom was it did not change after about maybe 16, 17. What you had is what you have. And it was fascinating to see that in the early 2000s, some of these MRI studies started to demonstrate, actually, that's just not true. First of all, development continues way longer than we thought. There are brain changes that are happening all the way into your, you know, mid-20s, maybe about 25, that are just part of growing up. That's a normal part of development. But then learning new skills actually physically has traces that you can measure in a brain. So you could learn to juggle and you could see how linking that hand-eye coordination changes certain parts of your brain. Or you could learn to read and you could see how vision and sound are linked differently and what that allows you to do. And for me, that was really exciting because, you know, 20 years, 30 years ago, I suppose, the idea that that could even happen was just considered, you know, known to be false. And I love when science throws us a curveball and says, yeah, that stuff that you knew, nah.
So it's funny you mention that, because I do now want to talk about, I think what you termed earlier, the seductive power of neuroscience. And I think you're absolutely right. It does have a seductive power. We've talked a little bit about the uses of neuroscience. I'd now like to talk a little bit about the abuses of neuroscience. And I think the technical term here, we'll have to switch the explicit tags on Apple, but I think the technical term here is neurobollocks. So what exactly does this very technical term mean, Joe?
Well, I just love that term in part because it's so delightfully evocative. I'm an American living in Britain, so bollocks is a phrase that just makes me laugh. And I think that there's certainly a lot of my countrymen agree. But what I was drawn to with it is this consistent misuse of neuroscience. And it is based on this kind of seductive allure. So there's some very good psychological behavioral science that has shown that simply adding brain science, brain images, brain terms to an otherwise perfectly normal story increases the amount that people believe the story, that how much they remember it. And it's a really robust effect. It seems to occur. I mean, it's not massive. It's maybe a 10% increase, but it seems to occur across populations. The only group that seems to be immune to it seem to be psychology professors. And it goes the opposite way. It just annoys them. And as a psychology professor, I am one of the people who gets annoyed by neurobollocks. So, but you see it all the time. Like there's a product on the market at the moment that's called NeuroWrap, I believe. And it is a scarf that you wrap around your head that has little red LED lights in it that's supposed to improve cognition, stave off dementia, you know, I don't know. They probably claim it makes you taller and happier. I have no idea. They're just insane, these kind of claims. And it's a scarf with red lights. Okay. That's what it is. It sells for £400 because they've dressed it up in all of this incredible neuro-nonsense. And if you are a normal person and you don't know that this is complete nonsense, you could easily be sort of seduced by it because the website's very flash and it has a lot of terms and it says, you know, you can see our science. And if you click on that, there's essentially no science there. But if you don't have a science background, how would you know, right? So personally, I find that deeply offensive. And just like Neuro Agua, which is bottled water that has the word neuro on it that sells for about £7 a bottle. It's water. But if you're willing to pay £7, then I guess somebody is incredibly happy and walking away with your cash. But and I think it comes in different levels. These are the kind of abusive misuses of neuroscience that, from my perspective, there are lots of neuromyths that are out there that I would say are also neurobollocks, but they're not. They're probably not being used to exploit people. So one of the classics is this idea that people are left-brained or right-brained. So the idea is that the left hemisphere of the brain is more logical, more math-based, more language-based, and the right hemisphere is more creative, it's more emotional, it's more musical, etc. And that if you are an accountant or a scientist, then you're a left brain person. And if you're a musician or if you're Taylor Swift, then you're a right brain person. But the reality is that that's just wrong. We've known it's wrong since about the turn of the 20th century. You use both of your hemispheres, left and right, for all of the activities that I've just described. And there are some subtleties about hemispheres being maybe a little bit more involved or less involved in certain things, although even that's pretty subtle. But, you know, you see these on social media. You can do these kind of clickbait quizzes. Are you left brain? Are you right brain? Or is your brain a male brain or a female brain? Well, if you're unsure whether you're a male or a female, then you might be unsure whether your brain is a male or female. That makes total sense. But if you are confident in your gender, then that's what your brain is too. Like, there aren't these differences that get portrayed so commonly in different types of media in particular. You know, the 10% brain myth, super popular in films like Lucy and Inception and all sorts of others, where you can unlock the full potential of your brain by surgery or drugs or whatever it is. And Morgan Freeman will tell you that you'll be able to, you know, do telekinesis if you do that. And, you know, Morgan Freeman, everybody loves him. He sounds plausible. So people walk away thinking, somehow I only use 10% of my brain. No, that's just nonsense. So I think it ranges between sort of misunderstandings, misconceptions in the literature that probably aren't particularly harmful, although I still object to them because that's kind of my area, to people who are sort of actively exploiting this seductive appeal for profit and frankly are you know, using it to take money from people in a way that I think is not legitimate and is not, they shouldn't be doing it. I think it's fraudulent, frankly.
No, thank you. Those are some great examples. The left brain, right brain thing, yeah, you hear it all of the time. It's something that has really permeated the popular consciousness. I think the other one of the similar ilk that I wanted to ask you about was it's had various identities over the years, but the triune brain idea, that you have a lizard brain or a chimp brain, that essentially you have three evolutionarily distinct areas of your brain. And essentially, if your brain isn't doing what you want it to do, it's probably because it's your lizard brain rather than your more evolved brain. Would you like to talk to the listeners about that one?
The lizard brain is by far my favorite neuro box. And in fact, when I talk about or write about sort of examples of neuro-nonsense, I typically do it in a lizard brain scale, where one lizard brain is the sort of myth misconception and four lizard brains are the sort of completely fraudulent misuse of neuroscience, and with, you know, obviously a scale in between. So the idea with lizard brain is that as you said, this was known as triune brain theory, which is to say that there are three brains. You don't have one brain, you have three brains. You have the evolutionarily oldest parts of your brain are the brainstem, and it's become related also to the basal ganglia as well, but relatively old. And you can find these in reptiles and fish and lizards, etc., which is true. And then you have layered on top of that sort of an emotional brain. This is sometimes it's the chimp brain. It depends on what different uses. And this includes structures known as the limbic system that involve emotional and memory processing and things like that. And then on top of that is your neocortex, which is actually true of all mammals. And this is your more rational brain. So if you think about things in terms of a sort of system one, system two, Danny Kahneman kind of approach, you could say, oh, well, this fits what we understand from behavioral economics. We have rational approaches, which is our system two, which would correspond to the neocortex. And then we have this sort of more emotional, you know, maybe animalistic kind of innate set of responses that are more system one. And Kahneman and Tversky's work shows that actually most everything's happening in this system one space, this non-rational space. And it's worth noting that Kahneman was very clear. he doesn't make that distinction. And in fact, it's a false dichotomy. It doesn't map on that way at all. The reality is that you have one brain and it has multiple parts. Those three parts are important parts of the brain. Weirdly, it ignored the cerebellum, which is the part of the brain that has the most brain cells in it. So it seems strange to ignore, you know, like 40% of the brain. But nonetheless, it was this idea that was put forward in the 60s by a psychiatrist who was trying to explain sort of some approaches to trauma therapy. And it was popular for a little while until being roundly debunked basically in the 70s by the rest of the neuroscience community, and said, look, it represents a misunderstanding of the basic anatomy of the brain. It represents a misunderstanding of evolution. It's not the case that you have a brain that, you know, evolved over the first, I don't know, 100 million years, and that's our lizard brain. And then on top of that, you layer an emotional bird brain or something like that, or chimp brain. And then on top of that, you layer the human bit. It's this idea that you have this kind of onion with a lizard at the center, which I find a brilliant visual and totally nonsense. What happens is that all of these things have developed in parallel in our species and other mammals. And that development changes the way all these parts function. So it's, you know, you have a bit of your brain that is common with lizards. And the parts that are common are doing things like keeping your heart beating, keeping your eyes moving, keeping you breathing, all things that actually matter for lizards too. Very little to do with things like making decisions, let alone consumer decisions or social decisions. Lizards aren't social species. All of that is really happening in your neocortex. And of course, it has influences to the other parts of your brain, because you still, you know, maybe if you're in a risky decision making, that's going to increase your heart rate or, you know, increase your breathing rate, because you might get into fight or flight situation. And of course, that's happening, but it's not, that's not driving the decision making. It's actually a consequence of decision making. So the lizard brain myth is one of my favorites, because it just seems to me so goofy, but it's remarkably prevalent, and I get it a lot from people.
I think it's prevalent because it's a great story. The way that it's often told, you know, it chimes in with evolution. It just kind of makes intuitive sense, right? We've evolved more than lizards. The way that it's expressed is really compelling. Unfortunately, as you say, it has a slight downside that it's utter nonsense.
But even the idea that we've evolved more than lizards is not true. Everything that's alive on the planet at this moment has exactly the same amount of evolution, right? We've evolved more than proto-humans. So if you go back 7 million years before humans and chimps diverged evolutionarily, we've evolved more than them. But of course, they died 7 million years ago. So that's, you know, kind of a low bar to jump over. In contrast, lizards, anything that happens to be around at the moment, your cat, your lizard, your fish, they have exactly the same amount of evolution that you and I do. They are here at the same point in time. It's just that our evolution has diverged over that time.
Look, you don't have to convince me. I'm not a purveyor of the lizard brain. My left brain is far too rational for that, Joe.
That checks out.
Look, I'm very conscious of your time. This has been a great conversation. Thank you so much. Do you have any final tips for our listeners on how to use neuroscience, maybe just how to avoid misusing neuroscience?
Well, the one thing I would say is that these days, information is so much more accessible. And particularly getting back to the AI, a lot of times, if you're interested, I think that there's a lot of opportunity, but I think that is, you have to be buyer beware. You have to look and understand that what you're getting is what you really want, and that it can answer your question. And if it's, you know, hidden in a lot of neuroscience gobbledygook, which frankly, scientists like myself do, it's a default and it's not a good one, then if you can't understand it, pop that stuff into GPT or Claude or something and see if it can't give you an explanation that's more sensible. Because even I do that with neuroscience, and I've been in the field for 25 years. So what I would say is, there's incredible potential here, whether it's gaining new insight or whether it's gaining new sort of marketing materials to get your reach, grab attention in an effective, non-nonsense kind of way. The opportunity's there. But you have to do a little bit of sort of legwork to just make sure, convince yourself that you're doing something legitimate and right, and it's going to actually help you. When in doubt, reach out to some people at your local university. We're not always brilliant at answering, but they don't have a vested interest, and they probably do care to make sure that you're getting something that's decent value. So I would say between the AI and friendly random academics, there's an opportunity to get extra information and be confident that what you decide to do is a good choice.
I think that's great advice. I will personally be asking ChatGPT immediately after this whether I should buy that £400 blanket with the red lights on.
It's clearly good value.
Bit of product placement there. Thank you, Joe. Really appreciate your time. Hope the listeners enjoyed that as much as I did.
Thank you, James. I really enjoyed it.
People don't think what they feel, don't say what they think, and they don't do what they say. That's that quote from David Ogilvy that Joe referred to early on in our conversation. And for me, that quote sums up what's so fascinating and so powerful about neuroscience. We all live our lives believing that our minds consciously decide our actions, believing that we can understand and explain our own behavior. But the reality is, we have no access to the workings of our brains. I can't explain to you how or why my brain made a decision or why I did what I did. All I can do is make up plausible sounding stories. And I can convince myself, and often others, but in reality, I have no idea if that's what really happened or not. It's an illusion. Joe's study for Audible expresses this perfectly. The participants, as you heard, were certain that they preferred video, but the readings from their bodies and their brains told a different story. The study on Colombian gorillas learning to read is a fascinating example of neuroplasticity. The brain is a physical object, the most complex in the known universe, and it physically changes as we learn new skills and have new experiences. That's arguably the single key insight of neuroscience, and it raises some profound existential questions. How does a physical object give rise to our conscious experience of the world? That might seem like a dry philosophical problem, but in a world of rapidly improving artificial intelligence, it's more relevant than ever. Could the right combination of computer chips and electronic circuits produce consciousness? For so long, organizations' approach to human questions has ignored that insight from David Ogilvy. If we want to know how our customers or our employees feel about something, we ask them in a survey or a focus group. If we want to know what they'll do or how they'll respond in a particular situation, we ask them. But the answers we get aren't always accurate. They can't be. We don't understand how our own brains work. We just tell plausible sounding stories about why we do certain things or why we feel the way we feel. And humans are suckers for plausible sounding stories. As the concept of neurobolics illustrates, the idea of a lizard brain or chimp brain being left brain or right brain, these are really plausible ideas, which is why they're so pervasive. But they're both, to use a technical neuroscience term, complete bollocks. Neuroscience has incredible potential for organizations and for societies to truly understand humans and human behavior. But it also has incredible potential for hucksters and charlatans. Beware of neurobollocks.
You've been listening to The B Word, a podcast produced by Izzy Rakic and Armani Williams, and hosted by me, James Healy.